Possibly because I've lived in a Buddhist country and quite happily hadn't really thought to visit Sri Lanka, and obviously having a great deal of interest in Lord Buddha and Buddha's central teachings and his life. I have visited India many times and led pilgrimages to the holy sites, but I met Mr. Prabhat last year and he invited me. At first I was going to come in December and had to cancel that trip because our venerable monk here had to have a head surgery, which he, I'm happy to report, recovered from. And but we were able to make it, and I was able to bring Ajahn Pabro along. So far we have appreciated and enjoyed the experience very much on our first evening in Anuradhapura. We were able to go and pay respects at the Sri Mahabodhi tree and meditate under the tree for 2.5 hours. And it was wonderful listening to the Pali chanting in every direction, all around us, and consider. And I hadn't really given a lot of thought to Buddhist history in Sri Lanka until this trip. But similarly, as when going to other holy sites in the world, the sense of appreciation of, firstly, of Lord Buddha, and of course the effort that Lord Buddha put into becoming a Buddha, and then the result of all of that merit, all of those qualities, that he has such a huge following of very capable people, and giving some thought to how Buddhism spreads and changes, appears to go through periods of degeneration and regeneration, dying off in a certain part of the world only to become strong in another part of the world. It's very interesting. Sitting there meditating and occasionally thinking, you know, how wonderful it was, considering things like, for 2,200 years people have been practicing in this place just like this. How wonderful, ancient living tradition. Of course, not knowing that much about Sri Lankan history, I discovered the day after when we were visiting some other sites that, of course, Anuradhapura area was invaded and everybody fled, and for 800 years nobody was practicing there. And now it has been regenerated again. So we see this theme again and again in the world. I've visited Ajanta and Ellora caves in Aurangabad in India. Similarly, for about 1500 years, a thriving Buddha center, and then all of a sudden, no more. Reclaimed by the jungle. It was an Englishman who went hunting, saw a tiger on top of one of the caves and stumbled across the Ajanta Caves complex quite by accident. And so we see these periods of growth, development, spreading of Buddhism, and then we see conditions change. Similarly to this Sri Mahabodhi tree planted by Sanghamitta Bhikkhuni, you can see that the original tree has probably died and something has grown up from the root, a regenerated tree coming from the root. So this is an interesting metaphor or simile to consider. You know, what is the root of the Bodhi tree? What is that which is absolutely based in Lord Buddha's teaching and which has the power to become a fully grown or fully blossomed practice? And so of course we have the Four Noble Truths, and then we have the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. One of my favorite ways to describe Lord Buddha's teaching, the Buddha's path, is the five spiritual powers. So in one of the weeks after Lord Buddha attained to his Nibbana, he was considering what it was that he'd realized, recognizing that his realization was so amazing, so profound, so wonderful, difficult to penetrate, but the most rewarding possible outcome: complete cessation of every type of suffering, liberation, enlightenment, whatever you want to call it, but the culmination, evolution of the human or conscious potential, fully realized. And then he realized that it was five powers when cultivated. The phrase he used was, these five spiritual powers, when cultivated, made much of, lead to the deathless and merge in the deathless. So samsara being the realm of death, conditions, having the nature to arise, stay for some time and cease. So what Lord Buddha discovered, nibbana, having a deathless nature. The mind that is liberated and experiences nibbana does not degenerate from that state. So he realized that five powers, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration and wisdom, lead the mind in only one direction, the direction of the deathless. So I also think that there's a reason Lord Buddha presents these five powers in that order. It's not necessary for people to cultivate them in this order, but obviously strong faith is very helpful. And of course we have to give some thought to what it is we actually have faith in and why we have faith in it. And when we give some proper thought to that, then our faith becomes deeper and more dependable, more powerful. So faith then that as a conscious being, we have a potential, and that potential was fully actualized, fully realized, fully demonstrated by Lord Buddha. But it's very important to consider that Lord Buddha started a long, long, long time ago as a patujana, or a worldly being. Quite possibly at some point he had even more greed, hatred and delusion than us. So I think this is very important to consider, because we can deify the Buddha. The Buddha is so wonderful, so beautiful, so special. Of course it's true. And that's the final outcome. So one of the things that my preceptor in Thailand, Lumpur Liam, says is that purity is born from impurity. It's a very interesting statement. Another thing that Lumpur Cha said is that the place of practice is right where the suffering is. That's another interesting contemplation, and I'll say a bit more about that later. So I guess what I'm pointing to is that we do need to have a good look at the nitty-gritty, raw experience of what it means to be a deluded being with greed and hatred who suffers. This is an important place to begin, and I'm happy to assure you that it's a place with infinite potential. And if we're able to look at this truthfully and give proper attention to the path of cause and effect, lay the proper causes with correct understanding, our situation gets better and better. Lord Buddha also says that there's nothing quite so beautiful as when a mind of a being that was especially non-virtuous, when that being becomes virtuous and it liberates themselves. It's like a beautiful full moon once the clouds part in a cloudy sky. It's so beautiful once that purity is revealed, when the clouds of darkness dissipate. So we have potential. We have a workable situation. That's really what Lord Buddha demonstrated. And he did also say it's not easy. It's not an easy thing to accomplish. Fortunately for us, it's easier for us because Lord Buddha explained how to do it, whereas he had to work it out himself. He did also train as a bodhisattva under, I believe, 22 Buddhas. So Lord Buddha, of course, received a lot of instruction, a lot of encouragement. This is another thing that we need to consider, that as great as the Buddha was, he wasn't great just by his own efforts. He was great because he had great teachers. And he was great because he paid heed to the advice of his teachers and he practiced appropriately. At the time when Sumedha received his prediction under Dipankara Buddha that he would indeed be a teaching Buddha, he was already a very, very remarkable yogi. Apparently he had all the jhanas and all of the psychic powers and could have become an arahant that day. What he said was, being a man aware of my power, wouldn't it be better to cause a multitude of beings to cross over as well? I agree that in his case it was better. I'm very grateful that Sumedha had that courage, that boldness of character, that determination to liberate himself and also cause a multitude to cross over. So here in Sri Lanka we have the result of Lord Buddha's dispensation, obviously, with King Asoka and his children, bringing the Bodhi tree, planting the Bodhi tree, and quite extraordinary. I'm no expert on Sri Lankan history, correct me if I'm wrong, I've only been studying it for 2 days. But from what I hear, the entire kingdom took on a different way of writing, became Buddhist at the king's, fortunately for those beings, under the king's guidance, took on a new script, a new way of writing, and a new religion, and started practicing Buddhism. So really wonderful. And then you have 2,200 years, but of course, what I discovered yesterday is Sri Lankans trace their Buddhist lineage, their Buddhist history, right back to the time of the Buddha, where it is believed that Lord Buddha visited Sri Lanka several times. Thais believe this as well. Thais believe Lord Buddha visited Thailand. Certainly he had extraordinary abilities and powers, and why not? With regards this Bodhi tree sprouting from a Bodhi tree that seems to be dying and becoming a healthy Bodhi tree again, this is an important thing to consider. We'll get back to the other, all five of the spiritual powers, but I just want to give this a little bit of thought. In this day and age, over 2,500, nearly 2,600 years since Lord Buddha passed away, obviously we have, in terms of the Sangha, we have a Bodhi tree with some rotting wood, some worms, some mold, some sour fruit. As Buddhists, because I'm quite sure many of you traditional Asian Buddhists are people of a faith character, then what do we do when we see bad monks or bad news about monks, and how do you maintain your faith? This is an important reflection for modern Buddhists, Asian Buddhists. And I think it's really important to just understand this is normal. This is normal. That after 2,600 years, there are lots of signs of decay. We have to be careful when, in the times where we feel appalled or disappointed or losing heart, that we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, as it were. So it's good to give some thought to what is Sangha, and what is refuge in Sangha. So the Sangha isn't just those monks and nuns who are practicing today wearing robes. The Sangha is the great disciples since the time of the Buddha, the foremost disciples. And it's those monks and nuns who are practicing correctly now. And actually we don't know in terms of percentage how many there are, we don't know. But we do know that there are some. And certainly I myself, very fortunate, I know a good number of well-practiced and well-practicing bhikkhus. That's my good fortune and I'm very grateful. Something that Thanajan Gunha, who is a nephew of Lompo Cha, said, he said, the Buddha sasana, the Buddhist religion, is mindfulness and wisdom. So he said, those beings who have mindfulness and wisdom functioning in their minds, that's the Buddha sasana. That's a very interesting thing to consider. In terms of the present moment Dhamma, in terms of what practice means, those beings. So perhaps a good number of you in this room have better mindfulness and wisdom than a good number of monks and nuns. So in that respect, you are part of the practicing Sangha. And then this helps us to understand what does it mean for the Sangha to be refuge. Lord Buddha's our refuge because he demonstrated the potential and he worked heroically to be as a Bodhisattva, as a teaching Buddha, in establishing his order, in laying things down so that they would last a long time. The Dhamma is not only his teachings and instructions, it's ultimate truth. So his teachings and instructions lead us to realizing ultimate truth. And then the Sangha is those who have practiced and those who are practicing well. So one has to understand that if you see something uninspiring and disappointing in the robed members of the Sangha, then it's actually your time, your turn, your time to join the team and practice harder. Don't let the team down. We shouldn't be. In Thailand, it's a bit frustrating because the lay people tend to criticize the monks. The Sangha in this day and age is degenerating. The Sangha is so terrible. And they always point at the Sangha and go, boo, 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 boo. Of course, as a Sangha member, I can look at the lay people and go, boo, 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 boo. Because it's not something that happens just because of the monks. What do I mean? So I've met a good number of young men who didn't particularly want to become monks. We have this tradition in Thailand that you can become a temporary monk. Mum and dad force them to become a monk. They become a monk. They might be a monk for 3 months and they realize, wow, the Buddha's teachings are wonderful. This practice really works. I feel much more peaceful. I have much more clarity. I really have faith in this. This is something I could give my life to. And then mum and dad force them to disrobe. And then it might be the son that nobody wants to marry. It might be the son that didn't get accepted to university. It might be the son that just got off drugs, or it might be the son that got out of jail. That mum and dad say, why don't you become a monk? And then we have a situation like we have now, where those who would have been very good leaders, if they were able, became bank managers. And those who perhaps should never have put a robe on, unfortunately did. And who are we going to blame? That's not the monk's fault, is it? Anyway, I'd like to say that because it's good for people to not completely believe their perceptions and challenge their perceptions a little bit. And then the much better question to ask is, what can I do? What can I do as a Buddhist practitioner to help the health of the Buddhasasana? And the obvious answer is to practice yourself. At least that's what seems to be the obvious answer to me. That, you see, if the monks meet lay people who are well studied and well practiced, this is going to have an effect on their level of shame and conscience. I better behave around these lay people. But also because things are always changing, in this day and age, we have access to more quality translated Buddhist teachings than I think ever before. That's amazing. In this day and age, we also have the potential to be distracted, unfocused, and lazy than ever before, which is unfortunate. So what it comes down to is focus. Maintaining a focus and maintaining a discipline so that these qualities of mindfulness and wisdom become powerful in your mind, and so that you are part of the Buddhasasana and part of the Sangha. So coming back to these five spiritual powers, we have faith in Lord Buddha. We have faith in the potential of a human being to eradicate greed, hatred and delusion, and to fully actualize the result of Sila, Samadhi and Panya training in the threefold training. Then it comes to practice. And here is where mindfulness is incredibly important. And then we need to talk about what we do to generate and sustain mindfulness. So if you can have consistent mindfulness, then this is what's going to give rise to energy, the second of those five spiritual powers, good, wholesome, clean mental energy. Consistent mindfulness and good energy, well, that's what converges into samadhi. Mindfulness and some samadhi, when we pay attention correctly and contemplate wisely, that's what results in true wisdom, penetrative insight into the true nature of things. So if we understand that greed, hatred and delusion are like a dark quality, they darken the mind, and it is in all of our minds, then mindfulness is like clear water that we use to wash away the darkness. very, very important. I was talking with I won't mention his name because I don't want to embarrass him, but I was talking to somebody prominent in Sri Lanka just yesterday, and he told me he's in no hurry to go forward. He's going to let other people go forward. He has a duty to do, and he's going to do his duty to serve the Sangha. And I went, no, 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 no. There's no standing still in samsara. There's no standing still in one's practice of Buddhism. If you're not going forward, you will be going backwards. That is my belief. And Tanajana Nan, and I've experienced that in my own practice. You think, I've been practicing hard, I need a little rest now, I deserve a rest. And it doesn't take long for things to to degenerate, slip back somewhat. So Tanajana Nan, he says, the Eightfold Path is something which is functioning in your mind. It's not what we chant in the Dhammacakka Sutta. Samma sati, samma sankappo, samma vajja. That's part of it. That's the map. That's the directions. Where right intention functions is in your heart. Where right mindfulness occurs is in your body and in the space around your body. Right mindfulness knows a thought is a thought, wholesome is wholesome, neutral is neutral, unwholesome is unwholesome. That's what mindfulness knows. It knows a feeling is a feeling. So we have to generate this clarity, presence of mind. And if we don't, there's these wonderful analogies in Theravadan Thai forest tradition. See, there's frogs live in holes, and outside of the rainy season they dig themselves into a nice little hole and they kind of sleep there for a long time waiting for the rain. And Tanajan Jandi said that someone who has some samatha but isn't yet truly wise, the villagers come along with a nail at the end of the stick. They stick it in the hole, they pull out the frog, and the frog becomes a frog shrimp chili paste. So he said that's what someone who has some well-being, some samatha, some faith, some sila, some dana, but not yet true penetrative insight, that's the situation we're in. So that when life gets difficult, suppose somebody really hurts you. So suppose somebody really betrays you. It might be your child. Looking at lots of middle-aged people in the room. So it might be one of your kids. It might be a partner. Okay, that's when you get to see how is your mindfulness? How is your commitment to metta? You see, when we feel hurt, we feel justified in being angry. When we feel justified in being angry, we feel justified in saying terrible things, doing terrible things. And then we make a lot of terrible karma. Similarly with passions. Maybe you meet somebody that finally, this is the one, really the one. And if your mindfulness isn't strong, you'll believe that thought, that feeling, that fantasy. And you just have to be with them. Because this is true love. The true love I always wanted. And of course, if you act on it, you could destroy your relationship and upset the members of your family, and not long afterwards you realize actually it's not true love after all. It was a fantasy. So mindfulness is important. We need mindfulness is what gives us a sense of perspective. Thoughts are thoughts, feelings are feelings. They arise, they stay for some time, they cease. Everybody has some mindfulness, but most people have what we would call weak mindfulness, fuzzy mindfulness, cloudy mindfulness. So it's like this kind of mindfulness can help you drive your car, can help you put on your shoes, but when you meet with a real challenge, weak mindfulness isn't enough to restrain you from acting unskillfully, speaking unskillfully. So this is, we need to see the danger in samsara. If you see signs of degeneration in the Sangha, then you better, what do they say in Australia, pull your finger out. You better start running for the finish line, because if you can't depend on others to lead you, I'm sure you can, I'm sure there are good monks, but in general, if it looks like you might not be able to depend on others, well then you better depend on yourself. So how do you make your spiritual practice powerful? How do you make it an energetic practice? Basically it comes down to daily commitment. A daily commitment which is absolutely unnegotiable. This is what it has to translate as. And you have to challenge yourself. when you don't want to do it, because Lompocha says the correct practice is this: when you want to do it, you do it. When you don't want to do it, you do it. When you're peaceful, you do it. When you're not peaceful, you do it. So that's correct practice. You can take it from an arahant. What happens from practicing consistently, when you're peaceful, when you're not peaceful, when you want to do it, when you don't want to do it, is that you develop a resilient quality of mindfulness that very, very importantly notices that mind states change. Sometimes you come to a sit, you don't want to do it, you don't want to do it, after 15 minutes you feel peaceful. Sometimes you come to sit down, you really want to do it, you think it's going to be a peaceful sit, and after 5 minutes you've got some painful memories that you just can't drop, and the mind is mulling over these painful thoughts, and it was an unpleasant experience. But what happens is that you develop patience, you develop commitment, you develop consistency, and you develop insight into the nature of your mind states. And there will be, in general, more and more peaceful moments. Having peaceful moments is what lays the causes for deeper peaceful moments, longer periods of peacefulness. That's the only thing that lays these causes. So you can think, well, my mind isn't peaceful. I don't want to sit because my mind isn't peaceful. Well, guess what? It's never going to become peaceful. However, if you sit with it when it's not peaceful, and sometimes it becomes peaceful, then you're beginning to develop your potential, cultivate your potential, and you're sowing the seeds for much deeper peace in the future. That is how this practice works. And obviously, if you can keep strict ethical standards, that's going to speed up the process, because you're not going to have things that you feel remorse about. And when you come and be by yourself, when you come to meditate, you have self-respect, a lack of remorse. And so keeping these ethical precepts is, it's not the case that Lord Buddha just says you should do this and you shouldn't do that. It's not like a judgmental, self-righteous statement about morality. Lord Buddha is explaining it, this is what is going to lead you to liberation from greed, hatred and delusion. This is what's going to lead you to be a truly happy, content, peaceful person. Trust me. And then it's difficult at first, because you have to go against desire, and then that's an unpleasant experience. In Thai they use the word phun, which means you have to resist. You sit down and you have to resist desires. You want to get up and go and eat something, you want to go sing, you want to go dance, you want to do anything but just sit there. But what happens is, when mindfulness gets stronger and some samadhi arises, because, I'll just say this first, energy is normally flowing out your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, and your desire for pleasant feelings. So there's all this energy going out, and that's what we're used to. The energy builds up, and we want to express it. And modern society tells us that that's what happiness is. Peak experience, expressing your desires, your passions, being passionate. So what happens is, you come to sit and you have that habit, is there's all this energy there that wants to go out. When you restrain it, and whatever the desire is for the pleasant sound, the pleasant touch, the pleasant taste, the pleasant experience, when the desire arises, stays for some time and ceases, the energy sits in the mind and begins to collect inwards instead of flowing outwards. That's what samadhi is. Samadhi is when the mind turns inwards, away from the six sense bases. What happens? The mind starts to experience rapture, tranquility, serenity, bliss. You wouldn't know that until you experience it. And Lord Buddha says that peacefulness is the highest pleasure. Guess what? Really good news. It feels really nice. It's not the case that you have to give up all of the fun and you have to have some dry, lifeless, unrewarding experience. The fact of the matter is, you give up your attachment to that sensual kind of pleasure and you get something superior. And from then on it gets better. Because when you start to combine your sati and your samadhi and you begin to have inside experiences, when you're able to have periods of time where the self-view falls away from your experience of the body and the mind, you don't realize it because it's there all the time. But it's a very, very contracted, limiting, painful experience. I mean, how many times, you know, this is the big hurt in your life. You know, how many times do we have that thought? I wish she didn't do that, she shouldn't have, he never, it wasn't fair, shouldn't have. How many times we have these thoughts, and how oppressive that is to us when we relive our tirade of grudges for all the people who hurt us who shouldn't have, and all of the people who spoke to us in one way when they should have spoke to us in a different way. And if some people carry this to their death, you know, even in the old age people's home, still being angry at their kids and angry at the husband or angry at their wife. And it's a thought and it's a memory based on perceiving things as a self. Now, if a person begins to have a diligent meditation practice, maintains their consistent mindfulness by generating it daily through a meditation practice, is determined to keep some of that mindfulness throughout their day, is ethical, generous to the degree that you can be, then you begin to have some inside experiences. You experience your body and mind without perceiving it as a self. And then there's a tremendous sense of relief in that experience of putting something terribly burdensome down. And if you can have what they call vipassana jnana, insight knowledges, and you can have that kind of experience as it changes your relationship to thoughts and feelings, you know, oh, that's just a thought, or that's a memory, that's the past. But that happened a long time ago. And you can start to challenge these things rather than have these things drag you around, dragging you up and slamming you down with our attachment to pleasure and our aversion to pain. You can just have the quite basic and obvious insight that most of us don't have, is that things from the past are the past. And we don't have to keep picking them up. And that if we're able to truly abide in the present and just be with the breath and see a thought as a thought and not pick it up and not believe the feelings, or if there is a feeling, we're aware of it as a feeling, aware of it changing, staying for some time, ceasing, then you can experience a great deal of contentment. And then practices like forgiveness become not difficult. Forgive the past, put it down, it's a gift to yourself. What a tremendous gift to yourself not to have to carry around grudge or anger. A mind that has some mindfulness and some energy, some samadhi and some wisdom, is able to do that. It's able to see a mind state as a mind state, see that it's painful, consider ways to let it go. Oh, I can practice forgiveness. Oh, I can just see this as a past. Oh, I can just put this down. And is able to, at least for periods of time. And then you begin to experience what it's like to have a trained mind rather than a mind that's dragged around by greed, hatred and delusion. So this Buddhist practice is truly powerful. I'm talking about five powers. Faith in Lord Buddha, very important to have faith in your potential. So if there's something in you that says, I can't do this, you have to challenge that. So actually you can. If something is the potential of all conscious beings, well then there's no exception. So you can't, that's a cop-out actually. Like, no, I can't do this. Yeah, you can. You might not be able to go as fast as you'd like to, but you can. And Ajahn Jayasaro used to say when I was a junior monk, I don't care if my disciples run or walk or crawl, so long as they're making some efforts and going ahead to some degree. And that is really what it comes down to. If you can't run, then walk. If you can't walk, then crawl. But we do need to be making efforts consistently. So how does that translate? I said to this man yesterday, please begin a 10-minute meditation per day and be committed to doing it every day. I'm sure most people here are doing more than that. If it's 20 minutes, increase to 25. If it's on half an hour, increase to 40. If it's 40, increase to an hour. If your life's too busy, if you can't do 1 hour all at once, do 2 sessions instead of 1. If you're already doing 2 sessions, please increase it to 3. I'm often saying this to my Malaysian students, that before they die, I want them to be meditating morning, afternoon and evening every day, because that's what makes mindfulness dependable, resilient and consistent. I was speaking with some people who said that they notice that when they're walking around they're still aware of their breath. People who are meditating more regularly, when they're walking around they're aware of their footsteps, even if they're in a public place. When they're having a conversation and they're not talking, they're listening, they're aware of their breathing. So this is what happens. So it's like when you meditate, you're not just trying to make the mind blank. It's important to understand what we're doing when we meditate. The mind can become peaceful, but it's not blank. It has a still quality of awareness. And that awareness is what we then take into every posture. And that awareness has some, it's often called sati sampajanya, mindfulness with clear comprehension, a sense of context. That presence of mind that knows this is wholesome, this is unwholesome, this is worth pursuing, this should be relinquished. And we bring that into our daily life, that awareness of what is right and wrong, presence of mind. It makes us much less reactionary. Many people ask me, how do I know if I'm developing my meditation? Because sometimes the more you meditate, it's like your magnifying glass for recognizing greed, hatred and delusion is getting better. So it's like, oh my God, it looks like it's worse than it used to be when I started. Not necessarily the case. That if you're able to see just how much unwholesomeness is present, this is actually growth. It's painful, but it's growth. And it's seeing it clearly is what enables us to not act on it and gives us the resolution to go beyond it. But it's very important when you see that you understand that that's not you. All of this unwholesome stuff that we see, that's not you. That's the result of past speech, past actions, but it's not who you are. It's something that can be let go of, not identified with. So you do your daily meditation practice. What many people find is in the past when they were reactive, they really want the carrot cake or they really want the brownie and they just had it, even though they might be very overweight, or they know that they shouldn't get upset with their kids or the dog or with their boss, but they've already yelled. And then afterwards it's like, I wish I didn't do that. But if you're having a consistent meditation practice, what happens is halfway through, you're able to say to yourself, just stop, stop, stop. Stop, that's enough. Because you recognize you're hurting yourself. And then as your practice develops, you're about to say it and you're able to say to yourself, stop, don't say this, don't do that. And it's not that you're not having the reaction might be fully there, but there's something else. There's a container of presence, of clarity, which is able to recognize this won't help the situation and this is going to make bad karma for yourself. As practice develops further, the reaction might be just beginning to happen and you're actually able to say, don't do that. Don't have this reaction. And you might be able to go to your cultivation of loving kindness instead. So if you're training on doing, suppose, 10 minutes of loving kindness in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, every day, suppose one has established that discipline eventually. Somebody said something very interesting, you're about to get irritated, someone says something offensive or irritating, unskillful, you're about to become irritated, and you're able to, you become aware, here is a suffering being, and you go straight to, may I be well, may I be happy, may I be well, may I be happy. So someone else might be wishing you harm, and in that moment you instantly wish yourself well, recognizing that you are a sentient being, one of all sentient beings. May all beings be well, may all beings be happy. You're one of them. You're just about to start suffering. Instead of reacting, filling that heart space with loving kindness as a samatha practice, that negativity may not even impinge. You leave it with them. This is where practice becomes very empowering and very encouraging. And instead of cultivating unwholesome karma, you cultivated wholesome karma in response to someone else's unwholesome karma. And this is perfectly possible for us, but it requires that consistent daily discipline. This is how you see that practice becomes powerful. So you start with your 15 minutes, you increase it to 20, increase it to half an hour, increase to 40 minutes, increase to an hour if you can, and then increase to twice a day, three times a day. And for people who say, I don't have time, I just don't have time, well then I would like you to have a look at how much time you spend on your devices. Do you waste time on Facebook? Do you spend a lot of time answering WeChat and LINE messages? It's a good question to ask yourself. When you're dying, do you think you're going to have the thought, oh damn, I didn't answer all of my LINEs or WeChats. I really wish I'd answered all of them before I died. How many people think they'll have that thought? Yeah, nobody. But when you're dying, you might think, oh, I wish I hadn't wasted so much time answering my LINE messages and WeChats. I wish I'd meditated more. That's a good mirror. Lord Buddha said we should contemplate death daily. If I die today, which is always possible, what would you have liked to have done today? So wisdom. In terms of contemplating wisdom, what is wisdom? Wisdom, to be understood most simply, is seeing things according to the three characteristics: impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self. So we have wise ways of thinking. That's one type of wisdom. But in terms of the wisdom that will liberate you, in terms of the wisdom that chips away at the delusion of thinking that you're a self, which is the real cause of the problem, then how do you cultivate this? When you're doing your daily meditation practice, I'd better talk a little bit about samatha and vipassana, because that seems to cause some confusion. Lompo Anan, my teacher, Ajahn Anan, he recommends making the mind peaceful if you can. So don't be frightened of samatha. Don't be frightened of just allowing the mind to be peaceful. Because suppose you're sitting for 40 minutes, it might take you 15 minutes for your mind to become peaceful, and your mind might stay peaceful for 15 minutes. And then what happens is it will move from that peaceful state by itself. For most people. Most people might have 5 minutes, 10 minutes, some gifted meditators might have 20 minutes or even half an hour of a peaceful, where they're really with that feeling of the breathing, not much thoughts, only wholesome thoughts. Even if your meditation is developed to that degree, the mind will become full of peacefulness and it will move from that state by itself. It's like it's full, it's rested, now it comes out. That's the time that the mind wants to do some work or is capable of doing some work. And one mistake that many people make at this point is that feeling of, oh, I've done my meditation, oh, that was really nice, and then get up and go to the fridge, or get up and answer your messages, or get up and watch TV, whatever. That is actually the time to do your investigation. And that's when you can develop what we would call vipassana. So you incline your mind to peacefulness. I recommend starting with 10 minutes of loving kindness. You know, we are living in a hectic era, and terrible things happen, as you know, happened recently in Sri Lanka. It's always good to have a metta practice. Well, loving kindness has a protective quality, it produces merit. Lord Buddha says that those who have loving kindness, their minds become peaceful easily. So it also weakens the tendency towards anger and hatred. So it's utterly wholesome. If you start with breathing in, may I be well, breathing out, may I be happy, breathing in, may I be well, breathing out, may I be happy. And you do that for the first couple of minutes, and then you might move on to breathing in, may I be well, breathing out, may all beings be well, breathing in, may I be well, breathing out, may all beings be well. And then come to the breath. So you use the thinking in a skillful way, give it a wholesome object, rather than thinking about other things, and then be with the breath. The mind becomes peaceful, allow it to be peaceful, enjoy it. And how often is it peaceful? You just kind of allow the mind to rest. Then when it moves from that peacefulness, that's the time to investigate. So usually there'll be some pain in your body if you've been sitting for 40 or 45 minutes. So make the determination, you're going to sit for the hour and you've got 15 minutes left. So then you just come to look at that pain. Is it one solid feeling, or is it thousands of little feelings in constant flux changing? Have a good look at it. And you'll see. Lots and lots and lots of sensations, changing, 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 changing. And then sometimes you can't stand it for another second, so you take 10 more breaths. Okay, I'm going to take 10 more breaths. And after those 10 breaths, the pain's gone down. And then it might come back stronger. This is when, okay, you're going to ask yourself, is it dukkha? Is this dukkha? Is this unsatisfactory? Yes, this has the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness. Okay. That's having a look at truth. And if every time you're agitated you move, you're not looking at that. We're in denial. But when you have a really good look at it, this kind of practice has enormous benefit, because whenever you get upset in your life, you're actually resenting a painful feeling that's occurring in your mind. Somebody says something you don't like, somebody does something you don't like. If you have an unpleasant feeling, you add your own aversion to that unpleasant feeling. This is an important thing to understand. It's not actually what they did. It's your attachment to what you want and what you prefer, and not getting what you wanted and what you preferred. And it causes pain in your mind. If you've developed a capacity to be with pain, physical pain, pain in the body, then you have some space and less reactivity around your mental pain. And this can save you enormous you make much less bad karma, because you'll find you'll be able to be patient with pain, mental pain and emotional pain. And then when you're able to be patient with it, you're able to contemplate it, you're able to consider, well, what would be the most skillful way to deal with this? What would be the best time? What would be the best way to say it? Sometimes you even have the insight, you know what, there's no point saying anything. And you just save yourself a problem if you're able to allow a feeling to arise and cease. So similarly with mental reactions, if we're able to see the arising and changing in this heart area, this is vipassana. Just watch what's an angry emotion like? What's a happy emotion like? What's rapture and tranquility? This cittanupassana, the texture of the mind, knowing the mind states. What's that like as a feeling? And becoming just kind of watching with whatever clarity you get from when the mind was peaceful, watching it change, watching it cease. And if this is the way that Samatha in Vipassana Lumpur Cha says, it's one stick, you pick up one stick and it has two ends, that sometimes the mind's going to incline towards peacefulness, and that's okay, that's Samatha. And then other times it has energy, get it interested, get it to investigate. That's your contemplation, which leads to Vipassana. But Vipassana insight is seeing things according to their impermanent nature, unsatisfactory nature, and ultimately not self. With regards not self, sometimes just have a look, you know, recognizing that thinking that we're a self causes us a lot of pain and suffering. Sometimes you can just come to your pillow and say, your meditation mat and pillow, and say, where is it? Where is this self? No, really, troublemaker, where are you? And then you go through, is it in the air? Is it in the nails? Is it in the teeth? Is it in the skin? You have a really good look. I'm looking in the mirror, my face, I think that's me, where is it? Is it in the eyelids? Is it in the nose? Is it in the eyelashes? No, no, no. What can happen is that feeling of grasping at things of being a self just falls away from the mind, because the mind sees it's not there. It trips over itself. And you begin to have an experience of a body and mind without a personality or an ego there. Self-view. Self-view is a habit, a habitual way of seeing things, an assumption. It's a very deep habit. It's not the truth. It's a conventional reality, but it's not ultimate truth. You can look more deeply as your practice develops. This is what a lot of the masters of the Thai forest tradition have done. Is it in the bones? Is it in the blood? What about where all these emotions are in the heart? Is that you? Close your eyes and consider what a heart is, that muscle which is beating. Is the self there? Is that me? And what you realize is, no, it's not anywhere actually. It's a combination of all of these things which we then perceive as a self, and we add this to experience. And we have to keep taking it off experience. And our attachment to it gets less and less. So I've been talking for nearly an hour. Five spiritual powers. Faith, you already have faith. It has to translate into faith and confidence in your potential. It has to translate into an energetic practice. That's what gives rise to energy, is making the effort. You have to make the effort consistently. Sometimes training for a marathon, for example, when you're not yet fit, when you're training, it hurts. Once a marathon runner is fit, then they can run the marathon, they're in the zone. You get yourself up to that fitness level and then you can do it. It becomes something that you can do, but while you're training, it hurts a bit. That's okay. But anything worth doing requires effort. So we have to commit to that. Mindfulness, when we meditate, we are aware of the feelings of the breathing, beginning, middle, end of an in-breath, space, beginning, middle, end of an out-breath, space. That very same awareness is aware of a thought, is aware of a feeling, is aware of a body as a body. And then if the mind becomes peaceful, some samadhi, allow it to be peaceful, allow it to rest in that firmness, in that collectedness, in that stillness. When it comes out of that peacefulness, then pick up the mindfulness again, know the mind states, know the feelings, investigate wisely. And these five spiritual powers will lead to weakening and uprooting greed, hatred and delusion, and actualizing and realizing your potential to be completely free of greed, hatred and delusion, and attain to what Lumbar Cha called unshakable peace. So I'll offer this much for your reflection. I hope something I've said has been helpful.